I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is Indigenous art and reconciliation. As anyone who has listened to the show before might know, I am not the world's biggest expert in art. We've done several shows related to the artistic world and art history that has demonstrated my relative ignorance on the subject of art. But a few weeks ago, I came across a book that really piqued my interest entitled Aesthetics of Repair, Indigenous Art and the Form of Reconciliation by Eugenia Kissin. And what immediately struck me in going through the description of the book is that Eugenia looks at belongings called art. So these are items that could have significant cultural meaning or were created outside of an artistic space that have been whether co-opted or introduced into the artistic world through a colonial gaze. So it's not necessarily the piece that has been produced for distribution as art. And the book looks at how explorations of subtler colonial harm associated with that process resonate with conversations about the aesthetics and care within the artistic environment. So ultimately, the book looks at the practices around art and artworks as forms of Indigenous philosophy and argues that a lot of the work draws on Indigenous ideas of justice. And in doing so, it takes a deep look at where contemporary art mixes with the process of reconciliation and contested practices that are related to the Indigenous settler relationships and the colonial lens. It's a really fascinating way to look at art. And a lot of the work is based on firsthand work that Eugenia has done over the years, working with artists, speaking with artists out in British Columbia. And adding a unique layer to the process is that a lot of the work was done while the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was going on. So there's this contemporary commentary that exists in the book as well. It really is quite fascinating. So I wanted to reach out to Eugenia to talk about the book. Again, as somebody who's not necessarily familiar with art, in our conversation, we kind of start with, well, what is art? That is really my first question in the discussion, but we really get into a lot of the big ideas in this book and then get into a couple specific examples, particularly one related to performance art that I found very fascinating and really enjoyed that part of the conversation. So overall, I really love doing episodes like this where it's a topic that I am not particularly familiar with. It gives me a chance to really learn a lot. And Eugenia was so great in explaining the book and getting through some of the examples. You can really tell just how passionate she is for this topic. So I really enjoyed this conversation. I think you will as well. So let's get right into my chat with Eugenia Kissin. All right. And Eugenia Kissin joins me now. Eugenia, how are you today?
I'm doing really well, Sean. Thanks for having me on.
Very excited to have you on to talk about Aesthetics of Repair, Indigenous Art, and the Form of Reconciliation. Now, we were talking before, and I'm not an art historian, and then you're not an art historian either. You trained as an anthropologist, but the book is about art to a certain degree. And one of the things that struck me or really stood out to me as I was going through the University of Toronto page for the book is under the description, the first sentence is Aesthetics of Repair analyzes how the belongings called art, and art is in scary quotes in that sentence. So I guess it's like to sort of give us the baseline of what the book is, how are you defining art and why in that sentence are there those quotes around the word?
So I think that is a great place for us to start, since it also helps me explain how I came to thinking about art as an anthropologist, right? So essentially the reason that it's in scare quotes is that it's not a kind of category that we can take for granted across cultural contexts. So anthropologists of art are very interested in how this is a kind of mutable, flexible category that changes over time. So what gets to count as art today, maybe in the past would have been unrecognizable. I think that's maybe what you were talking about before we started recording, how yes. some contemporary art just doesn't speak to you as, I guess, an expressive or aesthetic form. And so anthropologists are really interested in how things come to be defined as art when they enter institutions like museums and disciplines like art history. And we call those fields regimes of value to really signal how it is that something that could be considered a ceremonial object in an indigenous context can then be translated into something that is bought and sold as a commodity on the art market. So these different ways of circulation that actually change what is considered art and what is considered not art. And then adding to that from the indigenous context, there's been a big push in recent years on the Northwest Coast where I work to recategorize the things that we have called art as belongings to signal that they have these ancestral ties and connections. So putting that into scare quotes is really meant to call attention to all of those meanings. I think it was the Musqueam artist, curator, and scholar Jordan Wilson who first coined that phrase belongings, and it really has taken off because it really allows us to say that artwork is, you know, a human creation that is situated in networks of kinship and making and care, in addition to existing as this high value commodity in the art world.
So it does. So if I'm hearing you right and trying to understand this, essentially anything can then be art within this definition. It just has to be commoditized and bought and sold in that setting, that it's not necessarily the aesthetic of it or even the intention of the creator, whoever makes it. It's what happens to the object if it becomes part of this system.
So that's certainly one piece of it, the kind of institutional definition of art. I would say, though, that as an anthropologist and as a humanist, I really do tend to privilege people's intentions. So I'm very interested in what artists have to say about their own work. And it really matters when I'm looking at something from an earlier moment where the maker is perhaps not known or unidentified, that we kind of try to think about how that thing was received in the moment that it was produced, right? And how its kinds of means of representation produce meaning for its publics in that moment. So kind of a historical question, actually, about meaning and value. So I think that while possibly anything can be art, I do think that the kind of artwork that I think about from the Northwest Coast in this very sort of formalized form line style, there is a standard of things needing to be well made, actually, for those to be considered art.
Within that, though, how do we understand, because you mentioned ceremonial objects, so whether it's totems or ceremonial dress, like in those objects, my understanding would be they're made for the ceremonial purpose. They're, a lot of them are beautiful and have a wonderful aesthetic to them, but the intent of the creation is for the ceremonial purpose, and yet they become, a lot of them have become part of an artistic environment and become commoditized. So in those cases, how do we understand sort of artist intent versus the end use of the item?
That's a really interesting question. I think that certainly these different uses and meanings and kind of systems of meaning shape an object over the course of its social life, right? So I think that approaching work in the present, one has to be really sensitive to all of those kinds of transformations of objects. And it's also not a totally, foreign idea or process for something that was made for a ceremonial purpose to be decommissioned and turned into something that is more memorial or kind of a souvenir that's passed down through a family. So I think that that's a lot of what the book is interested in, is what are these different transformations in artworks? What makes them able to, or have the capacity to move through these different regimes of value? And in that sense, perhaps mean different things to different publics. So to give you just a more tangible example of this, one of the artists that I worked very closely with in researching and writing this book, Luke Parnell, who's Niska and Haida, he has this really wonderful concept of bilateralism for thinking about how something that he makes will signify really differently depending on what kind of public he is showing it to. And I think that that is maybe a sort of unsatisfying for some people approach to the question of meaning, right? Because we want to know, what does this mean? What is the story? How do we read this totem pole, right? Mm-hmm. But actually, I think that it's, there are some really profound ethical implications to the idea that the same thing could mean different things depending on where the viewer is coming from in time or in relation to identity or subject position.
I think that would presume, or we can presume that that exists with kind of all objects, right? That, you know, meaning is going to change over time. It's also going to change in context. And one of the things that, one of my favorite things in my whole undergrad career was the first time I learned about semiotics. Mm-hmm. And the example I think the professor used was a potato. And I was like, well, a potato is a potato. And he's like, no, a potato can be so many things. And like, it sounds kind of new agey and weird at times, but it also makes sense when you really think about it, that the potato for somebody is sustenance, for somebody else it's a livelihood. Just like, yeah, just that you could take those two examples. And for these objects, how does someone like Luke and yourself, how do you situate, say, the colonial gaze then within this? Because obviously that's a huge thread of the book and a lot of what is discussed. So objects that are viewed by the local communities out on the West Coast that you're working with and talking with, compared to how they are viewed through the colonial eyes, like how does that shape the way that the object is understood first, let's say, within the indigenous communities?
Yeah, so I think that I think it's really complicated, right? Because this is also not a sort of stable, pristine, or pure opposition. And I think that that was something I was really interested in doing in this book. So I'm, to back up a little bit, I'm not working with one particular First Nation or band or community. Instead, I was working with artists, many of whom came from mixed Indigenous backgrounds, most of whom had some combination of traditional apprenticeship or ceremonial practice in their community, and then a very, I guess we could say, colonial art school education, right? In a major urban center like Vancouver or Seattle or Montreal. And so I think that actually at this point, all of these meanings are quite entangled. And I think that there is a real and very powerful movement amongst Indigenous artists trying to think through how to reconnect with something that is only for and only within their communities, however they reckon where those are from. So I think that there is, at the same time, many of them, you know, they're artists. They want to show their work. They want to have exhibitions and be part of major collections in museums all over the world. And I think that there's really a tension there because, as you put it, the colonial gaze is very strong. I think that it's internalized by many of those institutions in how they display and care for the belongings in their collections. Now, I should say also that one of the reasons I wanted to do fieldwork on the Northwest Coast, specifically in the Canadian portion of this kind of larger cultural region, is that BC has been at the forefront of trying to mediate between these different perspectives and forms of care for art. I think that obviously this is not totally perfect, but when I first moved to Vancouver as an 18-year-old, I grew up in Toronto, so a different part of the country. I was so struck by how nuanced and sophisticated the conversations that were happening in museums were around precisely this question that you raised. How do we decolonize these kinds of technologies of display that really exist to distance artworks from their communities of origin? And people were very conscious around conversations about repatriation very, very early in this part of the world. I think because Indigenous artists and activists have been so vocal and really good at organizing around these questions.
So the book gets into the question of imaginaries of repair, contemporary imaginaries of repair. This is obviously the title is Aesthetics of Repair. So again, before we dig into that, because I think a lot of what we've talked about feeds into this idea of the imaginaries of repair. How do you define that in the book, and how is that work as a base of a structure to go forward with the analysis?
Yeah, so I actually came to this concept of repair only as I was writing the book. It as is often the case, I think you realize what you think about something once you're actually writing what you
Yeah,
what you
halfway read. Through and then you rewrite the whole thing. Yeah,
exactly. So I will say from the beginning, a certain kind of repair was on my mind because the time that I was doing the research for this book mapped on almost exactly to Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission on Indian residential schools, which ran from 2008 to 2015. And so there was a lot of talk and rhetoric and contestation around this sort of state idea of reconciliation and whether this was indeed going to work to repair the losses and violence of this really systematic cultural genocide, right? And so I think, how could repair not be on my mind in some way? Because in, you know, hanging out in people's studios and going to openings, I think that there was a sort of powerful tendency to be really skeptical of state-led reconciliation, right? A sense that it was dead before it even got off the ground. And so I was aware of that on the one hand, but it also became clear that there were these other sorts of, I don't know, practices that I would call reconciliation that were happening alongside this official process, right? So not necessarily what was taking place at the national gatherings or in the kind of archival work, but in, for example, an Indigenous-run art school that I spent some time at in Terrace in the northern part of the province, where students from a lot of different Northern First Nations communities were coming to be reacquainted with this art form, right? And so it was a kind of intercultural, trans First Nation form of repair that had nothing to do actually with the TRC, but was clearly influenced by this moment of, I don't know, forging a different kind of relationship to the past and what the truth is and what it could be going forward. So while I remain skeptical of the TRC and very disappointed in the number of the calls to action that have actually been implemented at this point, I really want people reading this book to come away with a kind of critical hope about the idea of repair, that this is still something that is worth pursuing and that the TRC did have an impact, I think, in the national conversation in a very real way that we should obviously be critical of and skeptical of, but still committed to. And so repair kind of emerged for me as a different, more intimate, more everyday concept of trying to improve relationships between settlers, Indigenous people, and also within Indigenous communities who have, you know, experience generations of dislocation and trauma and are really trying to suspend that damage. That's Eve Tuck's language, to get to something that is, you know, not coming from this place of damage, but is actually from a sort of I guess I would call it a sort of politics of resilience.
How much of that is related to agency for the artists and their communities? Now, as you say, a lot of this work was done during the time of the TRC, and I don't remember it that well in terms of how the process was received by communities across the country, but any large bureaucratic process, I mean, I live in Ottawa, professionally, I'm involved in this stuff every day. It can feel very impersonal. It can feel like it really moves slowly. So is there a part of this for the artists and the communities themselves that these notions of repair that you're discussing is taking back agency and having perhaps more of a feeling of controlling the process or being more involved in a process?
Certainly. And I think one really tangible example, I'm glad you brought up the kind of Ottawa context, is that communities have really pushed from the beginning of the TRC to have control over archival materials. And so I think that sometimes that was very frustrating as a researcher, but I actually think it's good that if this, as you said, this kind of impersonal bureaucratic process was going to dig into all of these really difficult memories for survivors, right? I think that there finally was a sense that those memories, if we were going to open up this history, needed to be cared for in a very conscious and protective way. And so I think that while there could always be improvements, I do think that that is a very clear example of communities having a lot of agency in how their stories would be shared.
So I'm also curious then about the question of art that is based on justice and based on reconciliation. Again, to give us sort of a baseline for people who haven't read the book yet or may not have seen some of the art and encountered the artists that you're discussing in the book, what sort of examples do you have in the book of this type of art? So practically, someone who's going and encountering, engaging with the material, what are they seeing?
Yeah, so they are going to be seeing work that often looks very traditional, meaning that it is kind of legible to an everyday audience as, look, this is West Coast First Nations art, which as you know, is this very, I guess, visible marker of this particular part of Canada. It's really, it has become part of the province of BC's brand, for better or worse, that it's this kind of expressive form that's really legible to people. But I think that many of the artworks that I talk about in the book, while they're kind of legible within that familiar system of thick form lines, thinner secondary lines, ovoid forms, U forms, split U's, all of that kind of vocabulary to represent these animal transforming figures, those are used in a kind of, I don't know, I don't really want to use the word hybrid because I think it presumes two sort of separate things that are mixing, but some kind of syncretic way with other sorts of contemporary issues. So to give you a really tangible example, Marianne Nicholson's painting, Oil Spill, The Inevitability of Enbridge, uses this incredibly beautiful visual language of sea mammals who are slowly being enveloped by a creeping inky oil spill. So you could look at the painting once and say, oh, look, it's marine life, it's an otter, it's a killer whale, it's something. And then if you look closer, you can see that something is not quite right. If you look even closer, you can see coins embedded in the surface, which are from the year of Enbridge's incorporation. So that was a big issue, just to back up a little bit when I was doing my research, was whether the twinned pipelines that they had planned through Kitimat were going to go forward. That project actually ended up not coming to fruition, but that painting from 2013, I think really, or sorry, 2011, really makes it, captures how inevitable and pervasive this felt at that time.
For the artists who you're talking to and working with on this book, How do they understand their intended audience? Who are they creating this for? We talked earlier about a lot of the ceremonial items and why they're created. For the artists specifically here, how do they conceive of audience?
I think it's always a sort of multiple position where you're trying to think about, obviously, the folks in your immediate community. And most of the artists that I worked with were very conscious of trying to tell stories that they had the rights to, right? So this is another important thing in many of the First Nations in this part of the world, is that stories are also property, right? They are passed down. You may have the rights to tell some things, you may not. And so artists were thinking about their families, so in this very local way, and then also about much broader audiences and collectors, right? Because this is also a really lucrative market and a way that I think Indigenous artists can make a living, right? By appealing to collectors. So trying to think about what is selling well is a factor in having this really, I guess, it's a kind of culturally meaningful livelihood, right? Something that you can do that also connects you to the community. And then I think even at another level of, posterity, how is this work going to circulate in international art markets and come to be in galleries where other people can see and learn about the artist's practice and lineages. So I think there is this really important aspect of display built into even Indigenous ideas about what this artwork is meant to do. It's meant to be displayed in order to solidify status in a community. And I think that that's a really interesting value that's shared between many Northwest Coast artists and many international art markets and systems.
Right. Is there an element of subversion in part of that, that some of these messages that, as you read the book, some of the messages are very challenging and very openly challenging colonialism and the colonial gaze. So even if the intent is that it's going to have wide distribution, a lot of people are going to see it, is there an element of subversion of, or even, I love stuff where, you know, if you look at something, you know, and if you don't know, you can still look at it and think it's a pretty like piece of art. Like, is there stuff like that happening within this material that allows it to go kind of mainstream while still having the cultural and community resonance?
Totally. I'm thinking specifically about a work by Sunny Asu, which is this kind of mask-like form, but it's made from logging offcuts in a community that was essentially destroyed to have a sort of suburban development project. And what he did with that offcut was put it into a case in the Museum of Anthropology with other Kwakwaka'wakw masks. So if you looked at it again, like just walking by, you'd think, oh, that's not a very good mask, but okay. If you know something about its context or form, or you decide to read the label text, you will learn that this was in fact a kind of piece of art by appropriation, where the artist used this wood offcut to say something very critical about colonial theft and land use and development.
Yeah, that's very, very cool. That's such a good idea, and speaks to so many different elements there. Another one that struck me in going through the book was Bo Dick and performance art and his caravan across the country. In addition to giving just a bit of a background on what he did, in particular, I'm curious about the idea of performance art and anything that is ephemeral, the idea that it's this moment, you do it, and then it's gone. That's very different from a tangible piece like a mask that you can put and it can go around, it can tour, a lot more people can see it than performance art. So just Bo Dick, what was he doing? What was sort of the interest for you as a researcher in that? And how do you place performance and the ephemeral within the tangible?
Yeah. So this performance was that the late artist Bo Dick carried out was essentially a public shaming ritual that involves breaking these large shield-like forms that are called coppers. And the reason that it is a kind of act of shaming is that it shows that you, as a hereditary chief, which Bodick was, have enough wealth and prestige to actually break this item. And so he did it twice, first at the provincial legislature in Victoria, and then on the steps of Parliament in Ottawa, while gathering this caravan that moved from the West Coast all the way into central Canada. And this performance also was very, very consciously tied to Idle No More, which was a movement that was gaining a lot of traction at the time, trying to think about, I think, Indigenous resilience and resurgence, again, alongside the TRC, but also in response to some very scary environmental changes that were going to come in as part of, I believe, an omnibus bill that I don't entirely remember the number of because it's been a while. But it gained a lot of momentum, and Dick really intersected with that movement. So it's actually interesting that you bring up ephemerality, right? Because protests are another kind of ephemeral performative form that nevertheless have a kind of afterlife and impact because they help build solidarity around a movement. And so I would say this copper breaking ceremony had a similar impact. It was televised. Dick was on the CBC talking about what a kind of disappointment it was that first that Canada, amidst this truth and reconciliation process, still were not having meaningful consultation around land and resource and water rights. And then also when Dick and his caravan arrived in Ottawa, they were not allowed to come into the Museum of Civilization. And so it was this kind of double moment of shame, which, as Dick pointed out on the news, was not our shame. It was not the shame of, you know, the Indigenous contingent that had arrived, but it was the shame of really a kind of level of government that was not recognizing hereditary rights. And it has also had a massive afterlife in the art world, I will say. There's as with most performance art, there's a ton of documentation. You can still find videos on, you know, YouTube. And the Belkin Gallery in Vancouver did a massive exhibition about this movement that has a really beautiful catalog too. So right. I think that while the action itself, as with a protest, is ephemeral and time-bound, I think that it has this kind of important afterlife, and that moment has really been a touchstone for people thinking about repair and the kind of paradox of repairing through breaking.
Right. Yeah. Now, as an anthropologist, this is more of a general question, but as an anthropologist, is there something about ephemerality that almost helps these sorts of things, that kind of like the old story, if you catch a fish every year, it got like a pound bigger or whatever. Like the idea of this moment happened, and yet even if we have video, the people who were there, as they talk about it and the story gets shared and it comes a game of telephone, like, does that actually help a piece? Because over the years it could talked about and nobody can, it's harder to not necessarily challenge the account, but the firsthand accounts are there and they're limited.
Completely. I think that that's a really interesting point from you as a historian, because I think that's totally true, that the kind of, so Dick was this absolutely larger than life figure in his lifetime. And I think since his really tragic, much too early death, he has become even more so, and that he really is this, I don't know, legend for younger artists working today, whose example they would like to emulate. So I do think that when there's a kind of dramatic yet ephemeral act that can then be told and spun into story that then continues to circulate in particular communities, yeah, absolutely, it has a big impact, and, you know, makes my job as an anthropologist very interesting, because I get to hear not only what these stories are, but what they do for people, right? How they inspire work in the present, because people will really very explicitly connect to stories from the past.
Yeah, there's a line at the end of The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which old Western, it's my favorite of the Westerns. I had to watch it for a class once. And the newspaper man says, when legend becomes fact, print the legend. And I feel like I always think about that, certainly doing history work, but in stuff like this too, where people are telling stories. I think of how we're going to tell the stories of the early days of March, or the mid days of March 2020 in another 20 years, and what that was like. So those sorts of things, I think, are, it's important to keep it in mind. Well, at the same time, you made reference to this. A lot of the work for this book was done during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That report came out in 2015. It is now 2025, and the book is out. What is it about this gap in time for you that, one, made you want to come back and put this together in this form, in this book? Because the end talks about, well, it's like over a decade since most of this research was initially conducted. So what is it about this moment, this time, that and how does the gap between the research, the time in which the research was done, and the time where you're putting this together in this form, how does that shape the way you think about a lot of this work?
I mean, I think this is the eternal question of academic publishing, because there's such a lag, both because, you know, the process of peer review takes a long time, and writing does too, because you're really, as I was, I think, grappling with what it was that you actually did over those 2 or 3 years of research, right? And I think that for me, the gestation period, that kind of distance, actually allowed me to see the time of my research as quite a significant turning point in Indigenous movements and rights in Canada. And I don't think I'm just saying that because, you know, you look at a contained set of years and see and impute some sort of period or value. I think that kind of reconciliation era, if we can call it that, did a lot of things. And one of them that the book takes up in much greater detail is that I think this idea that art could actually be a substance that intervenes into politics or works as a kind of container of memory that can be used as testimony. I think that idea, which certainly intersects with Indigenous ideas of belongings, right? I think that became much more mainstream. And so I think that audiences coming to see any kind of artwork now are much more open to thinking about what kinds of interventions it makes. So understanding that art has this efficacy or could have this efficacy that we seem to have put on it at this moment in history. And I think that's a really interesting shift in how we approach these questions of the aesthetic, that we actually expect even the most sort of, I don't know, traditional looking painting to do something. And I think that shift has in large part taken shape around these forms of action from that reconciliation period.
So for anyone who's coming to this book and is going to pick it up and read it, I think most people who would pick this up are probably familiar with some of the debates around, say, museums around the world using items from colonial exploits. And the book itself is focused in BC, but these discussions exist all across North America in various contexts. So how does this work fit in within the larger landscape of what's going on within North America, Canada, and really around the world? And for people who are coming to the book, what should they expect to take away from it if they're not from BC and don't really have a connection to the Northwest of North America?
So I think that connecting it to those larger questions around cultural patrimony and return, and really just ethics of display, right? And attempts to grapple with these colonial collections that were often assembled without consent or knowledge, right? So I think that one of the reasons actually that I ended up going to grad school in New York City and staying here is that the Natural History Museum has the most spectacular collection of late 19th century artwork belongings from this region. And that fact should give us pause, right? That this right. is that this is actually quite remote from the place where most of this work was made. And yet, because of this and because of all of the activism around repatriation that has happened over the past 30 years, it maintains these connections between other places. And so I feel like I always make the claim that this part of the world, even if it is sort of, you know, on the edge of the Pacific, it's very remote in some ways, is actually intimately tied to many other places in the world. To give you another example, when I was working at the Frida Giesing School, a lot of the teachers, this was in Terrace, again in BC, a lot of the teachers had been involved in carving a pole that they had sent in solidarity to Beishuan, to survivors of this major earthquake that had happened in 2008. And that, to me, was this really important form of international diplomacy that had nothing to do with the Canadian state, but was actually a First Nation asserting this solidarity with Indigenous people in China. And so I think that those moments, I really try to highlight them in the book, because I think that even if we tend to think about the West Coast within this bounded national context, I think that it reverberates in a lot of different parts of the world.
Yeah, very well said, and a very good reason why people should pick up the book and check it out. Again, it is Aesthetics of Repair, Indigenous Art and the Form of Reconciliation. Eugenia, if people want to pick up a copy of the book or follow along with all the work you got going on, what's the best way for them to do that?
So probably I'm very old fashioned, but you can feel free to email me. You can Google me at NYU and find my email address. I would be happy to correspond with readers of the book, and you can pick up a copy through University of Toronto Press. It's available in paperback and ebook form too.
Yes, I love the ebook. I love when they come out initially as the ebook form too, and paperback too. I'm not a big hard copy hardback fan. Like, I love the paperback version. So yeah,
this is like the only hardback version.
Yeah, it's I find them too hard to. Maybe I'm just weak. I find them too hard to actually hold up and read. It's just uncomfortable in my hand. So love when they come out with the paperback version. So again, it's Aesthetics of Repair, Indigenous Art, and the Form of Reconciliation. We'll link to the U of T Press page down below in the show notes, so you can check it out there. Eugenia Kissin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. Great conversation.
So there you have it, my chat with Eugenia Kissin, and I thank her for her time. And again, the book is Aesthetics of Repair, Indigenous Art and the Form of Reconciliation. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from the Williams Lake Tribune on December 27th, 2024, an article by Ben Fenlon entitled BC Indigenous Coffee Company Brews Truth Reconciliation One Cup at a Time. And this article profiles the Indigenous Roots Coffee Co., whose founders Natasha Parrish and Keir Portress both work in the field of Indigenous education. And Natasha Parrish, according to the article, her family has been in the coffee business for over 30 years. So she's bringing a lot of experience into this. And she notes that really coffee is a cultural thing. I don't drink coffee myself, but people who I know, of course, drink coffee. And everyone talks about get together, have coffee, you sit, you enjoy, you engage with each other. And she talks about that in this article. And the company has four blends of coffee, each of which are partnered with a different Indigenous grassroots initiative. And the goal of the company is to shine light on these initiatives and to promote, as they say in the article, Indigenous excellence, innovation, and courage. And each of the four coffee blends, the covers or the packaging of which blends the couple's Métis and Haida cultures, each has their own logo that were created by Chaz Elliott, an Indigenous artist. And you can really see, as presented in this article, the ways in which that they are trying to not only promote community, but build community in the company itself. So I think this is an extension of what Eugenia was talking about on the show and some of these ideas about using art as forms of reconciliation. I think what the company is doing in a lot of ways speaks to the idea of aesthetics of repair and building community and culture through art, or in this case, also through coffee. So a wonderful profile here of this company, which is based out in Victoria. So if you're out there and want to check them out, or really anywhere across the country, you can check out their website, which is linked in the article below. So today's historical headline of the week from the Williams Lake Tribune, Ben Fenlon, December 27, 2024, BC Indigenous Coffee Company brews truth, reconciliation, one cup at a time. And with that, I'll say thank you very much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Like, rate, comment, all that good stuff helps other people find the show and keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of the past episodes are there under the podcast tab, plus all the great written material that is available over on the site. And of course, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, whatsoldisnews@gmail.com. So thanks again so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old Is News.